60 AM Emory and WBZH 910 AM W245CT Hayward.
Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
I'm Andy Field. The Justice Department charging five former Memphis police officers with federal civil rights violations for the death of Tyrae Nichols. U.S. Attorney Kevin Ritz.
The first two counts alleging civil rights violations resulting in death carry a sentence of up to life in prison.
Nichols died days after a violent traffic stop. Police say a high school student was killed and another in custody after a shooting at a Louisiana high school. Police say they had to airlift a third St. Helena College and Career Academy student to Children's Hospital in Baton Rouge. CDC director signing off on updated COVID booster shots. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy opening an impeachment inquiry into President Biden over claims of corruption in family and business dealings. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell not offering a response.
I don't have any advice to give to the House. They've got a totally different set of challenges than we do.
This is ABC News. Getting back to work in spite of a writer's strike.
Drew Barrymore might be the focus of all the wrath right now as she went back into production of her daytime talk show Monday with her own writers picketing outside and a lot of striking Hollywood calling her a scab and worse online. But she could soon have some company. Jennifer Hudson and The Talk are reportedly both getting back to work, even though both shows employ WGA writers. And word is Kelly Clarkson will join as well. Barrymore said in an online post over the weekend that she owns the decision to return. No word yet from the other hosts. Jason Athenson, ABC News, Hollywood.
NASA astronaut Frank Rubio now holds the record for the longest U.S. space flight. He surpassed 355 days Monday at the International Space Station. Astronaut Laurel O'Hara will replace Rubio on the space station when she launches from Kazakhstan Friday. Poland's workforce is losing large numbers of Ukrainian refugees to Germany, country offering higher wages and government benefits. Andy Field, ABC News.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers launched a legislative survey today, an unprecedented move asking all 132 legislators to take public positions on his plan to address workforce challenges. Republican Speaker Robin Voss and Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu have already dismissed the plan, but Governor Evers stated Wisconsin residents deserve to know where their representatives stand on these workforce issues ahead of the special session he called to address them. Indigenous tribes in Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin are asking federal officials to deny a utility's request for a loan to build a natural gas-fired power plant on Lake Superior. Dairyland Power is seeking a $350 million public loan for the project to cover their share of the cost of building the Nemadji Trail Energy Center power plant. The indigenous tribes call the project unthinkable in the face of climate change. The total cost of the project would be roughly $700 million. For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
The Cripes Cast with Charlie Behrens.
Today, I am talking to the owner of Funky Fresh Spring Rolls, my friend, Truman McGee. From an environmentally friendly perspective, yeah. The fact that it's frozen means that it's not going to waste.
I'm a cereal strawberry abuser. If you're a fruit and you're watching this, stay away from me, okay? Do not jump in my shopping cart because I will let you die.
Cripes Cast every Saturday and Sunday at noon across Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Yeah. Todd Albo would normally be sharing his dulcet tones with us, but you'll recall that last week, Todd was having issues with the cable company, with an internet connection. I'm now thinking, Todd Albo, did you break Spectrum? Are you responsible for this ESPN mess?
I seem to broke everything else, so it wouldn't surprise me, no.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday morning, 6 till 8. On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org, brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us. Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
Effectiveness of lumping in potential allies with the fossil fuel industry and those responsible for delaying action. But in a press conference, new U.S. Open champion, 19-year-old Coco Gauff, whose semifinal match was interrupted, says she accepts climate science and sympathizes with their goals.
You know, I 100%, you know, believe in that. I think there's things that we can do better. The moments like this, yeah, are history-defining moments. And like I said, I prefer it not to happen in my match, but I wasn't pissed at, you know, the protesters. You know, I always speak about preaching about what you feel and what you believe in. And it was done in a peaceful way, so I can't get too mad at it.
Good for her. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Kevin McCarthy. Kevin McCarthy gave in and, well, has started an impeachment inquiry, which I got to tell you should be entertaining, should be interesting to see all of the backbiting Trump wannabes jockeying for their 7-second sound bites. That's going to be the part that I find interesting. And look, you know, we'll see. We'll see what they come up with. They've got nothing. But, you know, we'll see where this takes us. And we'll talk about that. We'll get to some of that. I've got some thoughts later. But that's not my top story today. Top story today, Census Bureau. The Census Bureau today came out with some reporting that says poverty jumped to 12.4% in 2022, up from 7.8% in 2021. Poverty among children more than doubled. And you go, well, why'd that happen? Why, how? It's Joe Biden's fault. No, it's not Biden's fault. It's because we've got Republicans who demanded an end to the supplemental child tax credit. You know, that $250 a month for kids over six, the $300 a month for kids under six. You know, that stuff that was supposed to make sure that kids didn't go hungry. And what we found we can end poverty. We can. We found it out. We figured out how to do it. You fund it. And we found out how to make poverty worse. You also couple that with the with more Census Bureau bad news. U.S. inflation-adjusted incomes in the U.S. have fallen for the third straight year. And we're impeaching Biden for who knows what. I know his kid had a laptop and is a degenerate. Maybe that's what it is. And I'm sure we'll hear a lot about laptops. We'll probably see Hunter's junk again because that's the best they've got. But understand, the people who demanded an end to this meager program to help make sure that children don't go to bed hungry, these are people who thrive on desperation. They thrive on misery. And, you know, I think back to, you know, to George Carlin, who, again, you know, the more you look at Carlin, and I was a huge Carlin fan as a kid, the more you look at what Carlin had to say over the years, go back to the 90s, he hit the nail on the head when he said, look, the rich, they take all the money, they do none of the work. The middle class does all of the work, pays all of the taxes, and the poor are there to keep those middle class people showing up to those crummy jobs. And you go, that's reality. And I keep saying, and I've said this for a very long time, you have a Republican Party that hates working people. Clear, simple, to the point, they hate working people. Look at what they do. Not what they say, not, oh, how much we care. We love the children. We love the babies. Oh, we want to make sure babies are born. But what have you done to help feed them, to help clothe them, to help get them the health care, the education? What have you done? Oh, that's right. Nothing. And my mind goes into these really angry places because for me, it's very simple. And it comes back to eighth grade civics class. The teacher going, look, at the end of the day, when I asked, you know, which party do you find yourself? How do you figure this out? And they said, well, you know, you think about it this way. It depends on where you are. Are you closer to being rich or closer to being poor? And I was actually poor at the time. I said, well, you know, poor. He goes, well, then, you know, Democrats, because they support programs to help feed the poor, which things that I benefited from. Or if you're, you know, a Republican, you're for the very rich and tax breaks and, you know, individual hooray for me and the heck with everyone else, then that's where you go. And if, you know, if you're somewhere in the middle, you got to decide which you want to pay for, because you're going to pay for both. And that was the key in this, because I'm solidly in the middle, maybe a little bit upper of the middle. But I still think that we don't let children go to bed hungry. We don't let workers get screwed every time they turn around. And it's why I'm a union person, because I understand which side I'm on. I believe in hard work. I believe in jobs being the best anti-poverty program, which I've amended to union jobs being the best anti-poverty program. Yes, I believe in contracts for workers, because I know when an employer falls on hard times, when things are a little touchy, it's going to be my kids are going to go hungry. It's going to be working people's kids who are going to go hungry. So when I saw this billionaire, or this CEO, his name's Tim Gerner. He is the founder and CEO of the Gerner Group. He was given a little spiel. And this, now understand, we were talking about the Writers Guild strike not too long ago and said that, you know, one of the executives is quoted saying the strike will go on as long as people are still in their homes. We want them to lose their mortgages, their apartments. We want them to suffer. We want them to struggle. We want pain. And look, that's every strike. That's not just unique to this one. But you don't know who that guy was. Well, our guy Tim Gerner here went and had a, while doing an interview and on a panel, had the, well, I'm not going to say good sense, but went on to... I got to play the clip. I mean, this is, you got to hear this for yourself. Here's Tim.
I think the problem that we've had is that we have people decided they didn't really want to work so much anymore through COVID, and that has had a massive issue on productivity. You know, tradies have definitely pulled back on productivity. You know, they have been paid a lot to do not too much in the last few years. And we need to see that change. We need to see unemployment rise. Unemployment has to jump 40-50% in my view. We need to see pain in the economy. We need to remind people that they work for the employer, not the other way around. I mean, there's been a systematic change where employees feel the employer is extremely lucky to have them, as opposed to the other way around. So it's a dynamic that has to change. We've got to kill that attitude, and that has to come through hurting the economy, which is what the whole global, you know, the world is trying to do. The governments around the world are trying to increase unemployment to get that to some sort of normality. And we're seeing it. I think every employer now is seeing it. I mean, there is definitely massive layoffs going off. People might not be talking about it, but people are definitely laying people off, and we're starting to see less arrogance in the employment market, and that has to continue because that will cascade across the cost balance.
We've got to kill that attitude that workers value their lives and their time. We got to kill that because, you know, you working people, you're not doing a lot, but you're expecting a lot. You've gotten lazy. And I ask you, working folk, remember when you were essential? Remember when you were a frontline hero? Remember when you were doing your patriotic duty, going out there, making guys like this their profits? Remember when we were feeding the billionaires so they could stay home and stay safe? Yeah. Again, this is why I don't believe billionaires should exist. I think it's immoral. But again, this idea is not new. This is the old Jay Gould, I could pay half the working class to murder the other half. We just need to make working people desperate. And look, you've got a corporate-controlled media who's going to feed into this. So get ready for a lot of this messaging. Get ready for it. And we're seeing it. You're seeing it in all of the strike talk, especially the big stuff around, you know, UPS, if you remember that. The Teamsters saying, look, we're going to go on strike. What did we hear about Sean O'Brien? Union boss. What are we hearing about Sean Fain over at the UAW? A democratically elected leader of a union. He's the union boss. He's not the boss. He's someone representing thousands of people and their interests. And what does the media never talk about? The massive profits that these workers put into the pockets of these corporations and these shareholders. And understand, and I keep saying this, Sean Fain did not pull the 46% increase in wages out of some back orifice. He pulled it right from the executive suite, because that's what the executives lined their pockets with over the last 4 years. So he's saying, look, if it's good enough for you, good enough for us. But understand our CEO mentality. You should be grateful. You should be happy to have a job. And look, this guy's, give him credit for at least being arrogant enough to come out and say it live. They are going to do everything they can do to cause pain across the economy, to put you working people back in your place. And the Republican Party is right there with them. Let me say that again. Our billionaire class wants you back in your place. Desperate, pliable, grateful to have a situation. Even if it doesn't make ends meet, even if you don't have the ability to save for your kids' college, even if you don't have the ability to save for your retirement, even if you don't get health care, you should be grateful, because at least the scraps you're getting something. This kind of stuff should infuriate working people. And this is where I keep saying there is a divide. You've got to know which side you're on. And it's been a very long time. Very long time in this country where you see a CEO coming out and say, look, we want it. We demand it. Globally, we have to get people back into line. You working people. Because their profits are sacrosanct. We have to make sure that they're well healed. So when the belt tightening happens, it's going to be your belt, not theirs. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Got lots to get to. Quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I find it interesting. George W. Bush back in the news. George was happy to find out that he survived because Yazani Prezorgan, remember the guy who fell out of the, or was a human lawn dart? You know, the guy who tried to, you know, invade Russia with the Wagner Group and all that. Remember him? Yazani Prigozhin, I guess his name is. Evidently, a picture has surfaced of him serving George W. Bush dinner. And W. said, you know, we kind of quipped of, well, all I know is I survived. Yeah, yeah, there you go. Now, what's interesting, what I do find interesting is Putin has weighed in on charges against Trump. He says, quote, what's happening with Trump is a persecution of a political rival for political motives. He says this shows the whole rottenness of the American political system, which cannot claim to teach others about democracy. And I got to tell you, I find it cute that a guy who throws his political opponents out of windows and crashes planes is lecturing us about holding people accountable. And in fact, he probably ordered a journalist defenestrated moments before he made the claim. And who knows? Maybe he's back to his, what is it, Polonium 210 tea cocktail that he gave Alexander Litnikov. Yeah. Yeah, that's fine. But Trump, no, it's too far. Let's quick go to the phones. We've got Steve in Chicago on line one. Steve, how are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. And just as an aside, I too find it interesting in terms of, you know, the murder of Prigozhin, because I often wonder, who are the other people that were on that plane with him? I mean, if you find out that you're getting on a plane with Prigozhin, isn't that kind of like going to dinner with Jessica Fletcher for Murder, She Wrote?
Yeah.
I mean, like, wait, okay, like, I stand a one in chance four of dying here, so why would I get on this plane? But, you know, like I said, just as an aside. But, yeah, it's an important topic. You know, this attitude that this gentleman expressed, I mean, yeah, as you said, give him credit. This is what people actually think but don't say. He actually said it. And the reality is, this is the same sort of thing that if you go back in time, this is what feudalism was. You're lucky that I let you farm my land, and you get to eat, and you get to live in a hovel, and, you know, what do you have to complain about? And when you study people who have acquired great wealth, either they're born into it or they somehow acquired in the process of their life, they manage to convince themselves that they've earned it, that they're special. Even if they win the lottery, that they adopt this belief that, well, you know, I was just meant to have this money. There must be something special about me.
I was chosen.
And especially, yeah, exactly. And especially within the framework of the Protestant ethic in this country that plays such a central role in defining, you know, our work ethic and so forth. People actually believe that, you know, that work and how much you make and so forth is part and parcel of the equation of whether or not you go to heaven and what kind of heaven you go to. So, yeah, this all is something that we've exploited in this society and this belief system. And obviously, you know, there aren't enough super wealthy people in this country to make this a priority. So they have to, you know, somehow make it so that average people vote their way. And it's been said by some, you know, I mean, the problem with America, it makes everybody worry for the day that they're going to be rich. And this is how you get somebody who's working class, who's worried about, you know, the fact that we might repeal the tax cuts for billionaires and people who make over $1 million. You know, I mean, why in heaven's name would you care? Because you're convinced that because when we poll people, a majority of people think that they're going to be in the top 10% in the next decade.
Yeah.
Now, that's obviously impossible. And if you're in the top, you're in the bottom 10% in this country, you have a 1 in 100 chance of moving into the top 10% in your life. So this idea that, you know, you can just skyrocket yourself into that is ridiculous, let alone becoming part of the uber wealthy class.
Yeah.
And again, this is how you win elections, despite the fact that you represent interests that in no way, shape, or form are those that are shared by the vast majority of Americans. But, you know, instead you sell them on, they're trying to teach your kids trans stuff in school, and there's all of this stuff that's elevating African-American history and the gay agenda, and you can go down a long list, and climate change. You know, that's what you should worry about, not whether or not there's going to be enough money in Social Security for you, not whether or not there's going to be the fact that pensions have disappeared, you know, what we're going to do with Medicare. No, don't worry about those things. Worry about whether or not there's some trans book in the library where your kid goes to school, because that's the big issue in your life.
No, I mean, you know, and look, you know, the reality is this is how you get to a point where, you know, look at what's going on in Florida with the AP, African-American history courses. You know, they benefited. It was actually a good thing. This is the billionaire mindset. You know, slavery was a good thing because they got skills, Steve. They got skills that they could use and made their lives better.
Yeah, I mean, as it's been said, you know, before, you know, yeah, rich people are different than the rest of us. They have money.
Yeah.
Yeah, and once you have money, I know we like to say, you know, if money can't buy you happiness. That's true. Money can't buy you happiness. But all things being equal, it's a lot better to have a lot of money in this society than not. You have access to the best health care. You have access to the best food, the best housing, the best education. You don't have to worry about retirement. You don't have to worry about, you know, your day-to-day obligations as far as your bills are concerned. Yeah, all things being equal, that's the case. And the reality is that, you know, what exactly are we fighting for? I always believed that that society had to progress over time, and that, you know, after a certain number of generations, that we were actually going to keep moving forward, and that, you know, there might come a time when you have this perfect storm in which technology, along with advancements in the way that we think, our ideology has changed, that we don't value the almighty dollar as the be-all, end-all goal in life, and that there might be actually some shame in having too much. In the 19th century, when the robber barons had too much, a lot of them got the idea towards the end of their lives that, you know what, this is a bad idea. I don't look good in the press. I don't look good to the American people. So they decided to start giving it a lot of it away. And that's why you have Rockefeller Center and Carnegie this and blah, blah, blah. But you know, with all due respect, it's nice that a lot of them gave that money away and to worthwhile causes. But it doesn't make up for the fact that they underpaid people, they exploited generations of people, they were responsible for the deaths of untold numbers of people in this country. So, yeah, you don't get to buy off America by giving a lot of your money away.
And they were tokens anyway.
You should have thought of that when you were making.
Exactly. But they were tokens anyway. I mean, it was nowhere near what they stole. And as I've said, behind every great billionaire, there's a great crime. And it usually starts with screwing their workers. Steve, I appreciate the call, though. Thanks. As always, great stuff. Let's go to line two. We've got Alice over on line two. Alice, how are you?
Insane.
What's on your mind?
You'd be disappointed if I said I was sane, wouldn't you?
Well, it's predictable, so that's a good thing. So what are you insane about today?
Oh, well, a couple of things, actually. Number one, I just found it vastly amusing that Putin is repeating the Republicans, and then the Republicans turn around and repeat Putin.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, do you think that we're all stupid, that we can't realize that you all are exchanging info here and using the same propaganda?
It's a hoax, Alex. It's all a hoax, Alex. Alice, big hoax.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And then the second thing, I'm reading, you know, in WAPO and listening to the news and whatnot, and, you know, they're talking about the impeachment inquiry. And this just blew my mind. The specific thing that was said, that they're investigating to find out if Biden actually benefited from his son's business inquiry.
Right.
You know, not inquiries, but, you know, business
dealings. So is that what they've settled on?
Yeah. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute. Did we not just have half the Trump family involved in the government? And I don't tell me that Trump didn't benefit from, you know, Ivanka in China and the boys in Saudi Arabia and, you know, whatnot. And I thought, you know what? Okay. I think it's time that we start investigating these questionable activities that were going on by the Trump kids.
Yeah. Well, and see, this impeachment will be different because Democrats will not back down, and I'm sure some of that will pop up. So we'll see. It should be fun and entertaining, if nothing else, because, again, Republicans have shown us they've got nothing else.
Well, yeah, and considering you've got that James Comer, Jim Jordan, and then I forget what the other guy's name is that are the three that's in charge. And I thought, oh, joy.
Let the fun begin. I appreciate the thoughts,
Alice.
Have
a good evening.
Thank you. No, this is, again, you know, the reason I say this is this could be a major backfire. McCarthy has allowed the the Kook caucus to take over. The didn't have a vote because he knows he doesn't have them. And let the moderates off the hook by not putting them on the record because he knew they would probably have to vote. Because understand, in California, there are 18 congressional districts that Biden won in 2020 where Republicans hold those seats. 18. If those 18, you know, vote the wrong way, because these are fairly moderate districts, you could see a swing and Democrats could take the House just on this. And you got to think McCarthy knows that. But again, you know, he's trying to hold on to his job because you've got the Matt Gaetzes of the world trying to throw him out. This is exactly what I said from the beginning. I hope McCarthy becomes speaker. I want him to have the headaches. I want him to have the acid reflux, all the stuff that comes with it. And let the fun begin. Also, Putin praised Elon Musk for being an outstanding person and a talented businessman. And I would assume thanked him for shutting off Starlink so that the Ukrainian military couldn't attack the Russian ships. Do you think Putin would allow a Musk to exist in Russia? Do you think? Or do you think Musk would find a window? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1935. That was the day the United Rubber Workers Union was founded in Akron, Ohio. Akron was the rubber capital of the world. All the major companies were there: Goodyear, Firestone, Goodrich, and General Tire. In Akron alone, there were more than 40,000 rubber workers and thousands more throughout the country. After 30 years of struggling to build the union, hopes of organizing the industry were finally made real. The founding of the International came after a successful strike the year before. But the union was born amid growing tensions within the AFL. These were the years of industrial organizing that rivaled the exclusive skilled craft unions. Growing demands to organize the mass industries would explode the next month at the historic AFL convention in Atlantic City. The tensions between AFL leaders and rubber workers' delegates gave a taste of things to come. At the founding convention, rubber workers' delegates opposed a number of AFL leaders' demands. The AFL insisted on appointing officers. They threatened to withdraw financial assistance when the delegates demanded democratic elections. But AFL leaders backed off when unionists from across the city protested. Then, delegates voted down an AFL constitutional clause proposal to bar communists from the union. They also refused AFL orders to organize on anything less than a total industry basis. Organizing skilled workers into the United Rubber Workers became a contentious issue at the October AFL convention. It led to the fistfight between carpenters leader Bill Hutchison and mine workers president John Lewis, which precipitated the AFL split. By the following spring, the new United Rubber Workers Union would lead another successful strike that put it firmly among the industrial unions of the CIO. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Back to school. Bright-eyed youngsters are now back in our public classrooms, filled with questions about the world around them. Questions like, what happened to our school library? And where did our librarians go? Sadly, these wholly beneficial, caring educators are being dumped in school trash bins by loopy right-wing ideologues who are out to impose their bigotry and ignorance on America. They've been on a rampage of banning books and demonizing teachers, but now the extremists are saying, that's not stupid enough. Let's also launch a witch hunt against librarians. This authoritarian assault, funded by a clique of far-right billionaires and coordinated by their front groups, has been popping off across the country. But leave it to Texas Governor Greg Abbott to push it from extreme to totalitarianism. He has unilaterally seized control of Houston's school district, the largest, most diverse in Texas, installing his own whip-cracking dictatorial overseer. Mike Miles, a former Army Ranger and CEO of a corporate school chain, promptly decreed that to improve reading scores in his district, he would first eliminate librarians from 28 schools in Black and Latino neighborhoods and, second, turn their libraries into centers where students who misbehave will be disciplined. Also, Abbott's Education Czar demands that all teachers there must reapply for their jobs, agree to follow a centrally scripted curriculum, and be monitored by classroom cameras. Of course, elimination of independent educational resources and regimentation of instruction will reduce schools to state institutions for obedience training. This is Jim Hightower saying, and that's the point. The GOP's push to remake education is a billionaire's wet dream of a compliant, subservient workforce. Don't ask questions, just keep pulling that plow.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So a Washington Post op-ed columnist, Catherine Rampal, she had an interesting take on the polling of the economy. And it's one of those things where you just go, I'm not quite sure, you know where she's at. Open for discussion, perhaps. Her take on why the polling's not higher on the Biden's economic policy. She opines Democrats' economic agenda hasn't caught on because of, quote, their myopic focus on manufacturing. She goes on to say maybe Americans don't feel like Bidenomics is working for them because it seems to be fixated on a sector that almost no Americans work in anymore, that doesn't feel relevant to their daily lives, and that isn't actually doing so great right now. Now, look, there's a couple of ways to look at that, bunch of ways to look at that. And that's why here to help me work through some of this, wade through, if you will. I've asked my good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, always great to be with you.
So what do you make of this? Is she right? Is she right in that we're so removed as a nation from manufacturing that we have no idea? Or is she saying what, you know, what the CEO at the beginning said? We're all just a bunch of lazy people who don't want to do any actual work.
Yeah, certainly not lazy people. People, I think most Americans I know are hardworking and want to earn their paycheck. But I'm happy to walk through what turned out to be a big old bucket of neoliberal bullpucky that she laid out there. You know, it's like the 1990s woke up and not only wanted their music and fashion, but also their failed economic policies and to impose them on us, Rick, man. I don't even know where to start, but it was like, I think my jaw was dropped for the entire op-ed when I read that the first time and how divorced from reality it was. And, you know, we can, the idea that, I mean, first of all, there's no sector of the economy where a majority of the people work,
right?
We have a diverse economy. Some people work in construction. Some people work in manufacturing. Some people work in the service sector, which is not a monolith, as you know. I mean, there's many different elements to that. Some people work in energy. And I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So the idea that because manufacturing is a distinct sector, you know, and shouldn't get special treatment is kind of ridiculous. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why it could, and I'm happy to walk through those. But I mean, anybody with a factory town, anybody in a factory town knows what that factory brings when it's working. It brings, guess what? Service jobs, and it brings construction jobs, and it brings all the other types of employment that she seems to care more about, but doesn't understand what kind of supports all of that kind of spin-off economic activity, number one. Number two, I think that she probably forgets how critical a role manufacturing plays in innovation, in national security, in research and development, in providing job opportunities for Americans who don't have a four-year college degree. And does so for in areas of the country that are urban, that are rural, and that are small towns.
And I would add to that, Scott, you know, I would add one thing to what you said there. I would add identity. You know, as we did our Working Class Heroes tour, the one thing that kept coming back to is we used to make stuff. And, you know, I go into Trenton, New Jersey every once in a while when I was driving a truck, was doing it all the time. And there's a bridge that goes into Trenton that's all lit up at night that says Trenton makes the world ticks. Their commitment to manufacturing, because that's their identity. And I would argue that's a huge part of this that she's completely missed.
Yeah, absolutely. It is part of the identity. And she does say that, you know, she thinks that Biden and Democrats are doing this to appeal to nostalgia and to try to win, you know, white working class voters. Okay, that's her claim with all of this. I mean, the truth is, and you know this, that people in manufacturing are far more diverse than that. It's just not a bunch of white guys who, you know, used to vote Democratic and are voting for Trump now. That's not what manufacturing looks like. But even beyond that, I mean, and this is the thing that gets me. It's like the policy's working. Yeah. I mean, this is what I don't understand. I mean, she talks about a manufacturing index, and this is very much reflective, this index of like what the Fed is doing on interest rates, or the fact that consumers, after buying a whole lot of manufactured products during the pandemic because they couldn't go anywhere, are finally going places. And they're buying a few fewer manufacturing goods right now than they had been. But, you know, I'm like, have you forgot all the semiconductor factories that are being constructed in America, or all the electric vehicle factories that are being constructed in America, or all the clean energy manufacturing facilities that are starting up in America, or the fact that manufacturing construction, you know, construction of new factories is basically at a level it hasn't been for a generation, or that we've seen very steady job growth in manufacturing, despite the fact that the sector is already very automated. It has a lot of robotics, but there's still a lot of people who work in it. And I'm just like, I don't know that reality persuades her. And I will just say this, that, you know, we've tried to talk to her before because she's written basically the same thing over and over again, and she's just not interested in the argument. And so I'm like, I don't know where to start with folks like that, other than to push back, to present the facts as they are, rather than, again, some like, you know, it's like, you know, it's like maybe she was a, and not to pick on anybody, but like a Toad Wet Sprocket fan in the 90s, misses them along with neoliberal economics. I have a hard time figuring it out.
I'm with you, because, you know, when you look at the things that are going on, there is a reorganization going on. In fact, the newspaper of the investor class, the Wall Street Journal, now owned by the folks, that used to be their tagline. It used to, you know, it was right on the front page, newspaper of the investor class. I'm not smart enough to make that up. They had an article, you know, talking about, you know, how, you know, as trade is struggling, there's a reshuffling of the world economic cards, as their headline said. And they said, look, you know, this is their words. The U.S. economy is chugging along while the rest of the world falls behind. We're doing, as you've said, we're doing better than the rest of the world. And they said, driving the division among the world's most powerful economies, a slowdown in trade that is hurting some much more than others. This is the stuff that we've been talking about: reshoring manufacturing, domestic production for domestic consumption, and this is the way that we take on China. It's enough. We've I hope given up on the idea of we're going to give our industries away in the hope that we're going to get cheap stuff back, because it hasn't worked. It's caused too much pain and misery.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point. That even, I mean, not that this, and I'm just going to say to average Americans how we're doing in comparison globally probably doesn't make a big difference, but it is an important data point, right? I mean, it's how you feel sitting around the kitchen table and how you feel in your community. But that is the truth, that our economy relative to everybody else in the world is doing pretty awesome right now. And, you know, there's a lot of obstacles that we have. I mean, we have, you know, Republican governance that may drive us off a fiscal cliff and certainly distract us. And we've had a lot of, you know, climate related issues that we've had to deal with. And we've had the Federal Reserve that is just, you know, keeps hammering on the interest rates, which push up borrowing costs for a lot of folks. But despite all of that, we're doing well. Wages are rising faster than inflation. And, you know, the jobs numbers look pretty good. And we are, again, you know, we didn't used to make a whole lot of very important things like semiconductors. And we're going to be, once again, a global power in that in just a couple of years, yeah, thanks to these investments. So I just scratched my head and I'm like, what world is she looking at?
No,
so,
and again, it comes back, it's the policy. I say sound investment, yeah, smart policy. We've been doing that, and that we're heading in the right direction. But understand, I mean, we're in a global situation where there's turmoil. And in fact, you know, I was just, the Financial Times had a piece, you know, saying that China is set to take over Japan as the world's largest car exporter. Where are they going to send those cars? Where are they going to export them to? Us. Which again, you have to have someone who's going to say, no, we're not, you're not going to be able to pump and dump. You're not going to be able to overproduce to stimulate your economy at the expense of ours. And thank goodness we got a guy in the White House who's saying that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I am deeply concerned about this. And I just, I want to express how large this problem is. Okay. So, and first of all, you know, the automotive sector is the heart of American manufacturing. It directly employs and then indirectly supports a ton of other jobs. And you know this, Rick, just being around the country, that, you know, towns have auto parts factories, or they have tire and rubber factories or glass factories, all supporting, or steel factories, aluminum, all supporting the automotive industry. So it's critically important to millions and millions of livelihoods in the United States. And the challenge is that China, you know, again, has tons of automotive capacity. Their companies have been churning out millions of cars. And I saw one analyst's estimate that there are 25 million unsold cars in China alone. And just to put that in comparison, the number of cars actually bought in the United States every year, new cars, ranges from like 14 to 16 million. So you think about that, and that is a flood waiting to happen somewhere. But what that will mean is closed factories, lost jobs, and it would completely alter and disrupt the global automotive industry. And so, yeah, none of these should be coming to the United States. And if it takes tariffs to do that, that's what we need to do.
Yeah. No, but this is another part of the ongoing. Look, we're at war with China. I don't know if people get the we're in an economic war. Absolutely. We've been in a trade war for years. This is coming. And look, our military is now shifting its focus. You know, there was a story in a publication over in Japan saying, look, you know, you've got the U.S. Marines. They're shifting their focus to China as the real threat. You know, this is part of what's, unfortunately, what's coming down the road. And we'd better prepare our manufacturing base for anything that may pop up. Because I got to tell you, it's my view, a strong manufacturing base is a strong reason why maybe we don't get into a shooting war.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's the preventative aspect of all of this, Rick. And to be clear about the war, you know, China for decades has been waging, I would argue, through its policies, economic warfare on other countries, including the United States. And unfortunately, they've been aided and abetted by our own trade policies for a long time and global companies. And they've added, and we have made, over the course of successive administrations, every overture to China to try to persuade China to change this behavior. And, you know, Clinton tried to do it, and Bush tried to do it, and Obama tried to do it. And even Trump, despite the tariffs, he entered a trade deal with China, you know, trying to get the phase one agreement, trying to do it. And Biden, they're sending cabinet secretaries over, right? Gina Raimondo was just there, the commerce secretary. And so it's not like we're trying to, I mean, we're trying to extend a hand, and every time, you know, China's doing something to it. And so we do need to be prepared. And you're right. The best way to prevent a widespread conflict that would mean tens of thousands of casualties at a minimum, and also a global depression without a doubt, and serious harm done to America's interests in the Indo-Pacific region, including many, many allies, is to have a strong defense industrial base, strong manufacturing, and to show to China that we can project force in the Indo-Pacific, and that ultimately it's not going to be able to achieve its goal. It would be too costly. And to me, this is not saber rattling. This is actually preventing conflict. But we can't pretend like the Chinese Communist Party, Xi Jinping, are wanting to extend an olive branch to the United States of America and are harmless in all of this. This is not, unfortunately, the case. They have greater ambitions, and we need to make sure that we're prepared for to position ourselves to avoid conflict, but to do it through strength in the months and years to come, Rick.
No, and again, I go back to, you know, maybe it's just the history I learned of World War II. The reason that we succeeded was, well, we had oil supplies and we had a massive industrial base that could be turned over to war production. I've gone through manufacturing towns over the years, as you have recently as well. And what you see are hollowed out infrastructure. You see buildings crumbling. You don't see the manufacturing prowess that we once had. And fortunately, and I keep saying this is why I'm so high on Biden's policies. We're moving back to rebuilding, reshoring, and reorganizing that kind of manufacturing base. And I think that's incredibly important.
Yeah, it's happening. I mean, it's out there. All you have to do is open your eyes and look around. And if you look on any jobs website, the number of manufacturers who are hiring is astounding. Yeah. Every room I go to when I speak to manufacturers, I'm like, who's hiring? Everybody raises their hand. And I mean, there's never been a better time to look for a manufacturing job in this country. It's pretty great. But we got to keep the momentum up. We can't listen to people like Catherine Rampell. We can't let the Republicans roll back these investments. But on the same hand, we can't get rid of the tariffs that Trump put into place that Biden has also in place just because it's a policy that some other president did. We need to keep those as well as we move on.
I'm right there with you, Scott. As always, good stuff. Appreciate the time.
Of course, Rick. Great to be with you.
Thanks so much, our good friend Scott Paul. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. We'll get links out on social media. I can do that. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Good stuff. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Back after this.
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1997. That was the day that Union Square in New York City was named a National Historic Landmark. Republican Governor George Pataki explained the importance of the park in a press release. It is only fitting that the National Park Service should recognize Union Square Park's long history as a focal point for political expression. New York is proud that the first Labor Day parade took place here in Union Square Park. More than 100 years ago, establishing a tradition that spread across the nation. Although the park was very important to the labor movement, that was not why it was known as Union Square. The park got its name because it was the place of intersection or union of two busy New York roads, what are today Broadway and Fourth Avenue. In 1831, the open space at the intersection was declared a public space. The space became an important location for labor rallies and political demonstrations. In 1882, the first Labor Day parade in U.S. history marched through the square, 10,000 workers waving their banners high. In 1911, union workers again gathered at Union Square to protest after the Triangle Shirtwaist factory fire killed 146, mostly young women and girls, some garment workers as young as 11 and 14 years old. In the later 1920s, the park was demolished for construction of the New York subway, but the the space continued to be important to the city's union movement. In 2002, a series of 22 bronze plaques were dedicated at the park to tell the history of Union Square. One of those plaques tells of the first Labor Day parade. Another is a collage of images of labor demonstrations and sheet music of labor songs. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Quote of the day from Christy. I'll say that, right? Who names their kid Chris Christie? Who does that? But anyway, our quote of the day from Chris Christie, while he was at a stop in New Hampshire, claiming that Trump is hiding behind the walls of private clubs and the Secret Service protection. He says, you think I'm going to have a hard time finding Donald Trump? You think that over the course of the next couple of months, I'm not going to find him and confront him someplace? Chris says, I was a prosecutor for 7 years. It was my job to find people and confront them. Don't worry about it. I'll find him. Okay, gonna do the where's Waldo on the Trump thing. And the weird thing is, if I'm Trump, I stay away from all of that. You don't want to get into one of those moments where you're being confronted. Are you surprised he's hiding? No, of course not. Now, what's interesting is the reporting that's coming out that actually Trump was privately discussing the impeachment with House GOP conference chair Elise Stefanik. That's kind of, well, now remember, she's the first member of the Republican leadership to come out in support of impeachment. So this is Trump thinking that this is going to help him. I think this is a miscalculation. I think this is going to make them look really bad because they're going to now have to put up or shut up. They've now got to come with something. And of course, we're going to hear about laptops and we're going to hear about, well, there was an email and we're going to hear all about that stuff. But there's going to be the other side of this. And what's interesting is you've now got an FBI agent who oversaw the investigation into Hunter Biden, now disputing the whistleblower. It's going to be all this stuff. And ultimately, there's going to be a lot of smoke. There's going to be a lot of mirror work. There's going to be a lot of sleight of hand. But I got to tell you, I'm not seeing the direct line. And while this is going on, you've got the Republican Party trying to purge itself of Donald Trump because you've got another Republican lawyer with ties to three former Trump opponents going, hey, we need to hold him off the ballot, disqualify him off of the ballot. Now, these are Republicans doing this because the Republicans don't want Trump either, because their thought is once people start seeing in these trials what the evidence actually is, it could change hearts and minds. It could potentially. Now, look, the most ardent red hats, the people, I don't care if he shot someone on Fifth Avenue and grabbed my wife by the you-know-what. I don't care. I still like him. That guy's never going to be movable. That guy's, well, he's down the road. But, people who don't pay an awful lot of attention, as this retribution impeachment happens, because again, it's all about retribution. The political article today, House GOP weaponizes impeachment because there's nothing there. This could be the beginning of their downfall. And look, McCarthy didn't have a choice. They were going to, the Kook caucus was going to throw him to the curb, which, again, always fun. I love John Fetterman's response. He had another one, please go ahead. This one was, oh boy, go ahead. By all means, do your thing. Play your hand. And, for me, I keep coming back to where we started today. None of this is making the lives of working people better. The Republicans have no plans. Democrats are trying. There's some stuff out there. We're going to get to some of that here in a bit. But again, there's no agenda there. Now you got Trump running around saying, I'm going to cut more tax cuts. Oh, okay, for who? You think working people are going to get tax cuts out of Trump? You mean like the last tax cuts, Donald? The ones where you made the corporate tax cuts and the wealthy folks' tax cuts permanent, but the nickels and the dimes that working people got, you know, had a sunset provision? And then actually we get to pay that back with interest? Oh, thank you so much. And this is where I keep coming back to. It's never been more apparent of which side you should be on than now. To me, it's fairly simple. You've got one guy who's on the side of working people. And it's not the billionaire, real estate tycoon.
You're listening to WLAK 1260 AM Amory and WBZH 910 AM W245 CT Hayward.
Always streaming on the Civic ABC Media app. News.